Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I want to remind you that it's all about compliance with the Constitution. I probably haven't mentioned, and I forgive me, there's just so many things I could put in the obligatories, little tabs, blah, 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 like, you know, the importance of learning, and so that we learn, pray, act. The champion of the Constitution in this coming campaign, the only one that is stepped forward, is Jerry Wistrand. And so if you want to support a champion who's really going to lead on change, and compliance of the Constitution and highlight this, then you need to support this campaign in Wyoming, or not Wyoming, forgive me, in Missouri. All right, I'm going to try to shift it down a little bit because it seems like I might be in high gear right now. And so welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And actually, one of the things that I wanted to do is a derailment, just real quick. There is a crisis that is brewing in America that is going to cause a huge problem, and this is this, I'll just say, the proliferation of data centers and AI computing. Now, I'm not sure where you sit on this because there's lots of people that are making, you know, comments of this is the way of the future, this is the way we need to go, and so forth. And anyway, so do you have I think we usually think alike on this. So what's your position or opinion on this?
Well, I do have a problem with the way that they're being instituted and the way they're being facilitated. Mm-hmm. They're just having these mega corporations go in and take over areas, and the people in those communities don't appreciate that, want or like it, and I get that and I understand it. But as far as the technology is concerned, it's just like every other technology. There are people, you know, thought the end of the world was coming when the first cars took off on the roads, or when the steam engine started, or when computers started proliferating. People are like, oh, this is going to be the end of everything. And it's that same kind of alarmist thing that we see all the time. And if it bleeds, it leads. So that's getting pushed. Mm-hmm. But I think that's one of the reasons that we should use areas like the whole thing we had about Greenland. That was one of the reasons that we wanted to have that as part of our, you know, our territory, whatever you want to call it. However the plan was, I didn't get too much into details, but that was one of the things that they wanted to use.
Sure.
Or, you know, facilitating Greenland. Yeah. Was the data centers, instead of putting them in neighborhoods and agricultural areas and using up space and resources that were for people. They have all the space and resources they need,
right,
in these wilderness areas that aren't really, they're not like fragile ecosystems. And it would be better to put them there because of the way they function.
Right. So
there's two sides to everything.
Okay. So I believe that there's a business case for these computing centers. I believe that there's truly a business case, but I don't believe that the business case, or I should say the strategy behind the business case, is a transparent one. And I believe that, and I'm going to come across as the conspirator or the conspiracy theorist, but I don't believe global corporations ever put the rights of the people and, you know, their needs first. And as a matter of fact, in America, corporations that are not organic to a state has no constitutional standing to even go into that state to just do something.
Oh, absolutely. And so, I think that the government, the whole purpose of government is to protect the people, the people's liberties,
yep,
from these corporations. And instead, they've gotten into into bed with them, so to speak, and you bet. Against us.
You bet. And so here's foreign, because 9 times out of 10, every data center that's being, you know, proliferated through the United States, almost 90, if not more, there are going to be foreign operations within your state. They may actually be an American corporation, but they're not organic within your state. And so we're dealing with a hostile entity, because that entity has no interest in making your life better. They're going to come in, they're going to want to take your resources, they're going to demand your resources, and they're going to demand that they have priority over your resources. And if the business case is there, let me back up to the business case. If the business case is there for this creation of these data centers, then they would come in and offer they would be bringing in their own resources. In other words, they'd bring in their own power, they'd bring in their own cooling capacities or plan of how they're going to cool, and they would have I hate to sound like a woke person, they'll have the sustainability, you know, map of, you know, overview of how they're coming in, and they're going to be basically, you know, inconsequential to anything regarding the state resources. The only thing that they're going to occupy is the land itself. If the business case is there, then that's exactly what they would be doing. But it's not there. And as a matter of fact, right now, the business case for AI is free, practically. There's a lot of people that have free access to going in and doing nice things with social media. You know, you can use, you know, ever so many so many times a month or so many times to, you know, parse through your dialogues for parsing transcripts or doing video editing. They want you to get immersed in using it and involved. It's almost like what Apple did in the education system. By giving you these computers, now you become familiar with them, and then you're going to want to use their products. So they're basically offering all sorts of candy for all sorts of people to say, look at what AI can do for you. While in the background, they're using, and they have parsed out, you know, exactly what resources they are going to dominate. In other words, if you understand, you know, quotas and what we call thresholds of data, thresholds of CPU, so forth, they will always maintain control over what they need, and you will get what available CPU transactions, memory, and those types of things. And you'll be none the wiser because, you know, these things are so immense that they build in that extra. They build in that extra computing, that extra memory, that extra stuff that a computer needs so that it can function. The way I see this is that they're doing this, and they're proliferating it in such regional. And if you look at the way it's going, it's almost this perfect hub spoke design, where they're creating nodes all across the United States. And what can these nodes do? What is the capacity of these AI centers? Well, now you have a local access to be able to start feeding for ancillary computing. They can do this in the background. You can start feeding in all of this information to do geofencing, to do actual monitoring of whose cars are driving down the road. I mean, we're at a point now where if you're driving a car of a certain year, I think it's OBD2 or newer, onboard diagnostics for your firmware for your computer in your car, it broadcasts basic information, its VIN number and those types of things. They can keep track of you as you drive by. I mean, California's been doing this for a long time, or they've had the ability to do this. I think they are doing it. I don't know. I left the state a while ago, and I stopped looking over my shoulder back there. They have these abilities. with these regional nodes to be able to make it easy. See, if you go to these faraway reaches like Greenland, to tap in all of the communications for the entire United States for monitoring systems, that would be a massive network pipe. That makes sense, right?
If you're using wires, I guess it makes sense.
I mean, even if you're using fiber optic or if you're using satellite, I mean, that's a lot of comms, a lot of communications, because, you know, it's kind of like when you have a transaction that's occurring, information that's occurring, like a car going by, or, you know, the videos, all the different types of monitoring systems that they can pipe into these things. Each one is its own feed or thread. And so you have to have a transmitter for each of those, or that process of transmission. And so it becomes quite a bit, because even though it may be a kilobyte stream or whatever that stream is, it's got to have a dedication so that that stream cannot be interrupted. And so you have to, in the designing of the network, this becomes pretty massive of sending. Even a small state like Wyoming would create a very large pipe of technology, or I should say communications, of monitoring, because it's a big state. It's got a lot of roads and so forth, depending on the level of what you want to monitor. And these things are capable of monitoring everything. You have how much smart utilities in your home and smart appliances? It can monitor all of that. Right now, that's all being stovepiped. You know, the argument against the U.S. intelligence agencies were they were stovepipes, because they collected and kept their data, and it was isolated. The argument for these data centers is they get rid of the stovepipes. They're now able to collect and parse and process everything that's coming from your home and it's coming from your devices, everything that you're doing. That all being nice and said, I think that when we look at, you know, the necessity of using AI to a degree where it's coming into the state of Wyoming, I don't believe that the people of Wyoming would even tap a quarter of its capacity. I mean, a very small fraction even of its capacity of what it could serve the people of Wyoming. When we look at, you know, each of these data centers and their capacity. So, and the capacity is exponential, because in that same building space in 3 years from now, they'll be able to quadruple what they're doing, storage, processing, and so forth. And they do. And this is exactly what they're doing in all these other data centers. And over the past 5-6 years, there's these companies, they're parasitical companies that pop up outside of data centers. And what they do is they do the refreshing, if you've heard that term. Refreshing is where they take old hardware, they pull it out, and they replace it with new hardware. And it's literally just like, I don't want to say it's plug and play. There's a lot of integration that gets done by whoever's managing the contract. But all this hardware literally just gets replaced. The storage, you know, the storage devices get, because they want to be able to double their storage in 5 years. And the business cycle is that it's fully depreciated. And they've written all of that off. It's all been a part of their cost. And so now they can do more and faster in the same amount of space, doubling, quadrupling, and so forth. So the point is that there's these parasitical organizations that pop up, because the business that's running, or the few people that are operating that data center, you know, they don't have the time to, they just got to get rid of this hardware. So what ends up happening is these small companies, and now Amazon, if you haven't noticed, if you notice how Amazon is repurposing all of its data center hardware?
Well, of course.
Yeah, so you can buy it, but they actually create a brick and mortar. They have to have a brick and mortar store outside these data centers of theirs, so that they can push all this hardware to, and then and they already have the inventories, and it's easy for them to manage, and then offer, you can buy these drives. And folks, if you're looking for a high capacity, high performance drive, these enterprise drives, by all means, go on to Amazon. You could probably get a 16 to 20 terabyte drive, at a fraction of the price. And you go, well, it's used. Go look at the manufacturer specifications for these drives, and you look at the mean time between failures, MTBE, and or MTBF. And if you look at the, you know, it's, we're talking over 2 million operational hours for these things to fail. They're really well. These are old school hard drives. The point is that you do the math on how long that drive was sitting in some bay, you know, constant operation. It hasn't even lived a quarter of its life. So there, you're getting something that basically will outlive your need, because that drive has been built to, you know, function for 2 million hours or more. I think they're even going up to 3-4 million hours now. Because these spinning discs, they've been building these for so long. I don't want to say they're perfected, but they're really well built these days. And so anyway, the business case isn't there. I'm seeing lots of things that are, you know, very bothering. And I'm seeing a lot of people talking about this. And I see exactly what you're saying. They're making boogeymen out of this. But when you just use hysterics and emotions, then you can't really see, you know, the problem. But down the road, as the capacity of these things shift, their power requirements and their cooling requirements go up exponentially as well. And so now you have created a competitor. This is why I say don't let these things come in unless, and as a matter of fact, I would even have the states charge. In other words, you're going to pay, if you want to operate in our state, you're going to pay for every CPU transaction you do. I was on a contract with the government where the IBM has this database called Informix. And Informix was trying to kill themselves. And they knew this because Informix was a database that was used on very critical government systems. And this database just got so expensive. They deliberately were doing this so that the government would move off of very specific hardware. And so the way Informix was charging for their licensing was by CPU cycles. Every time a transaction was done in a CPU, you had to pay a specific fraction of a cent. And they knew how much that was going. It was going to make them very rich because databases are heavily transactional. I mean, they use a lot of CPU time or clocks, not time, but really quick transactions. So the point is that all of a sudden IBM started making a lot of money, and they actually killed their competitor that was dependent on this database system. They went out and bought it and did that deliberately. So there's no reason why you can't, you know, make and put into the contract as the state to say, you're going to pay us for this, because that's how we're going to pay off the resources that you're going to be taking. Yeah, you're going to pay for those, but we, you know, you're taking away from us, so we now have to accommodate for our users another system. So that's how we're going to pay for that. Because if they don't have these types of plans, then America is continually building and expanding without understanding the consequences of our future. A good case in point is how we have covered our most fertile land of growing food with concrete and asphalt. If you look at Orange County, if you look at King County of Washington, Orange County of California, there's plenty of other, the San Jose Valley. When you look at these valleys that are right there at the center of these cities, that is the most fertile soil, you know, for those areas and regions and growing food, but we've covered that up. Why? Because all in the need for having everybody move to the city so that they can work in the factories and work, you know, in and out, move them out of the fields and into the cities. And so we've lost a lot of great food production capabilities because it's super fertile soil. Anyway. And now we're just growing it out and using chemicals in the sand and the barren. I mean, the San Joaquin Valley is a very fertile valley as well. But there's lots of places that, you know, we've depleted, and we're using, you know, chemicals and science to basically grow food. And I'm going, okay, this is a perfect example of how we didn't understand what we were doing as we were covering up inch by inch our ability to feed ourselves locally. And now we're becoming more and more dependent on food sources that are further away and further away from us. So all of these things, I think, planners don't put on the table because they, you know, they get caught up in the opportunity of making the money, if that makes sense. So anyway.
They get caught up in being the facilitators for industry and playing it off as they're doing it for the people.
Excellent. Yes, that's an excellent point because they're doing their job. And as a matter of fact, their job may be to obviate these types of things.
That is their job.
Yes.
And that's what I was going to say in response to what you're talking about with the data centers. Every other innovation that we've experienced as a society has come from this drive to make things better, and this next iteration is the same thing.
Right.
The problem is that the government has been captured by these corporations for the sake of profits,
right,
instead of doing their job, which is safeguarding our liberties to evolve with the innovation.
Right.
Most of the innovation in the modern world has come from our free society.
Yes.
And at the same time, you have adversaries across the world who have a whole different idea of how government should be structured and about liberty of people that are working on these same innovations as well.
Yes.
For example, China, Russia, and other countries.
Great.
Where they're proliferating the AI. And if we do not keep pace or stay ahead of them, they will use that AI. They're already trying to use it to subjugate us and destroy our culture and our society.
Excellent.
So we have to find ways to get our government to safeguard our liberties while still proliferating these innovations.
Okay. So what you just brought up and you made the connection. Because the companies that created these 15-minute cities and this massive control system, these AI massive control systems in China, were American tech companies. Google was there, Apple was there, all of these big American techs, they don't want to tell you how they contributed this, 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 and this to literally help lock down the Chinese people. And go look at, and this is what I would say, look at how China incrementally deployed that system. And I'll bet you it started with AI or data centers. Data centers became common because we were building and selling the first data center to the government in the 90s. In the 90s. And so as we look at, you know, this, you know, what China did, they had to build all of these data centers for each of these little 15-minute city clumps so that they could start controlling people. And they had a plan, and they executed that plan. Don't tell me that what we see in America isn't a part of a plan. It's not just a coincidence that everybody's got to have a data center within, you know, 100 miles of your residence. If every resident of the United States, there needs to be a data center within 100 miles, or whatever that measurement is. And there's a reason for this, folks. And so, show me the business case, and I will show you that it doesn't add up. It does not add up. We don't need these things. Because you're right, I think that we could easily be served with remote capabilities of AI from Greenland, but they can't take the level of the ability to control us. You know, the ability to control us. They need to have these things proliferated out close to us to do that. Period. Because if you put them all in Greenland, then it's a single point failure. All we need to do is just drop the comms and we're all free. Or we can all run free for a few minutes until they restore the comms. You know what I mean? Anyway, we can kind of close this up when we come back. But what I want to do is get back into the Hamilton's orations or speeches during the ratification days. So we'll be picking that up when we come back, folks. Sorry for this little side, but I see this bubbling, and I wanted to get in front of this so that you start questioning, asking for business case and so forth. We'll be right back after this. Thank you.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Well, okay, so anything more before we move into the Hamilton speeches?
Just to close it out, I would say that, and a lot of people would say that it's the government's failure that they are allowing the proliferation of these corporations to our detriment, and it's been going on for a long time. It started with what we're talking about today, with these interpretations that were added on to the government that weren't intended, and that's how we've gotten to the point where we have these international corporations that are doing innovation here and then taking it to our adversaries and proliferating it there to our detriment. That shouldn't be happening at all.
Right.
But it comes back to a failure on our part because of our lack of vigilance, because we haven't kept the government in line, because, you know, oh, I don't want to fight that fight. That's too much. I got this to worry about. You know, I got to do this for my own benefit.
Yep.
And I think that's a fine line between the sacrifice and the rewards of liberty. That's where it comes down to. I mean, you have to be able to look at your values and your principles and decide, you know, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to allow this to continue, or are you going to take a stand for what you know is right?
Excellent. I mean, the only way I would have said that maybe better is that government haven't failed. We failed. We failed in keeping them in the box. We failed in holding them accountable in the very beginning. That what we look at today, corporations are doing this and integrating this, not because corporations are government. Corporations are the tools of the global government, of what they need in moving us towards full control. And so there's this symbiotic relationship between major and international corporations, whether they be communications networks, whether they be, you know, some level of tech, some level of enforcements and so forth. I mean, this is why we have mercenary enforcements throughout the United States instead of the militia. This is why it is so important to start actually implementing, because the Constitution gives us all of the necessary barriers and the checks and balances to ensure that government can't seize control of us. Anyway, so Phantom was the last thing we've kind of read, how, you know, Hamilton just, you know, throws it out there. And, you know, it's like this is the beginning of what we would call label lynching, where he uses a term to basically, you know, make somebody feel bad because, you know, they're looking at aristocracy as a problem. He says that's a phantom, and he's label lynching these people. Or actually, I guess there's another term for it. And what is it called?
Cancel culture.
You know, there's a word for it. Oh, is it ghosting?
Ghosting is something else.
It's not ghosting. It's another way of basically making somebody feel bad. Something lighting.
Gaslighting.
Gaslighting. Thank you. This is, I guess, the early days of gaslighting, because that's what he's doing. And it's not like he's providing really tangible evidence of how this is a phantom or how this is, you know, this is absurd. He doesn't want to. This is a man who knows what he's doing. He was the epitome of what we would call, you know, a self-serving lawyer. There we go. I'll leave it at that. Let's go to the checks and balances, where he talks about checks and balances.
He's one of the earlier politicians, because all I keep thinking about is Bernie Sanders talking about how we got to get money from these millionaires, and he's a millionaire.
Yeah. Right.
After all, sir, we must submit to this idea that the true principle of republic is that the people should choose whom they please to govern them. Representation is imperfect in proportion as the current of popular favor is checked. This great source of free government, popular election, should be perfectly pure and the most unbounded liberty allowed. Where this principle is adhered to, where in the organization of government, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches are rendered distinct, where again the legislature is divided into separate houses, and the operations of each are controlled by various checks and balances, and, above all, by the vigilance and weight of the state governments, to talk of tyranny and the subversion of liberties is to speak the language of enthusiasm. This balance between the national and state governments ought to be dwelt on with peculiar attention, as it is, of the utmost importance. It forms a double security to the people. If one encroaches on their rights, they will find a powerful protection in the other. Indeed, they will both be prevented from overpassing their constitutional limits by a certain rivalship, which will ever subsist between them. I am persuaded that a firm union is as necessary to perpetuate our liberties as it is to make us respectable. And experience will probably prove that the national government will be as natural a guardian of our freedom as the state legislatures themselves.
Mm-hmm. And so, interestingly enough, he actually points out all three branches. So he was aware that there were three, but he only mentioned two before. Again, it's the sleight of hand here. One of the things I kind of mention is, I think that when you see the as it is of the utmost importance, that period, that dot right there, I think in our writing, that dot has been changed with the space dash space.
Yeah.
As it is of the utmost importance, that little whole, you know, that.
Right. Yeah, that threw me because I was like.
Yeah. So this is when people get to that, when they're reading the way they're typing or the way this is kind of written, is that the end of a sentence? No, that actually should be like a dash. You know, creating an emphasis of that following. It catches people. And so when you see it.
Well, especially when you haven't read it before.
Yeah, absolutely. I get it.
And you're trying to follow along with his ideas. And then you come to that and you're like.
Yep. Well, and you'll notice it's kind of common in these writings. And so of their time, they didn't use, I guess, the dash like we deployed it today. Now, this talks about checks and balances and interposition. So let's see what he talks about here.
Sir, the most powerful obstacle to the members of Congress betraying the interests of their constituents is the state legislatures themselves, who will be standing bodies of observation, possessing the confidence of the people, jealous of federal encroachments, and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery. They will institute regular modes of inquiry. The complicated domestic attachments which subsist between the state legislators and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights. Possessed of the means and disposition of resistance, the spirit of opposition will be easily communicated to the people, and under the conduct of an organized body of leaders will act with weight and system. Thus it appears that the very structure of the Confederacy affords the surest preventative from error and the most powerful checks to misconduct. Sir, there is something in an argument that has been urged, which, if it proves anything, concludes against all union and all governments. It goes to prove that no power should be entrusted to any body of men because they may be abused. This is an argument of possibility and chance, one that would render useless all reasonings upon the probable operation of things and defeat the established principles of natural and moral causes. It is a species of reasoning sometimes used to excite popular jealousies, but is generally discarded by wise and discerning men. I do not suppose that the honorable member who advanced the idea had any such design. He undoubtedly would not wish to extend his arguments to the destruction of union or government. But this, sir, is its real tendency.
And it'd be apropos that right after I make a comment of the dash, here we see them deploy a dash. okay, so they obviously have them, but the way they do the dots, I think we don't do that at all. We don't create a period. So anyway, there's one thing to point out, and it is in that first paragraph. He says, this is what they need to do for the people jealous of federal encroachments and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery. This is what they're to do. They will institute regular modes of inquiry. The complicated domestic attachments which subsist between the state legislatures and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights. This is where this responsibility of interposition comes in. The word isn't here, but this is precisely what interposition is, folks, where you stand up and go, hold on here. Where did you get the authority to do what you're doing right there?
Or more likely, you do not have the authority to do what you're doing.
right. I get that. And Thomas Jefferson exactly took that approach. You know, there's two ways to do it. You can actually be very aggressive, or you can be passive aggressive. Direct aggressive, aggressive aggressive, passive aggressive. And asking the question, where did you get the power? Where is the power granted to you in the Constitution to be able to do that? Because that begs the question, and it actually forces an answer. To make the assertion you do not have the power then doesn't necessarily point to, you know, the fact that, because I like the passive-aggressive only for this purpose. It highlights where it must be. Where is that power delegated in the Constitution? And so when you just say you don't have that power.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay, yeah. All right. Back in those days, though, I mean, Thomas Jefferson was just, I mean, he was a very bold politician, very bold lawyer. Okay, so now we move on past another Hamilton oration for the day. And then we move into June 23rd, and there's a couple of Hamilton orations, but Hamilton doesn't provide anything in these next three orations. Nothing really meaty. Just kind of stands up, and these may be the points in time where he dives into theory. Isn't really proven anything. I mean, this right here, the sort of the most powerful obstacles, this is probably the strongest assertion that he makes. In the New York debates, that right there. And then there's three orations, a fourth oration on the 24th, and then on the 25th, another oration. Nothing of consequence, nothing really worth highlighting. So on Friday the 27th, Mr. Hamilton then gets in and again talks a bit about checks and balances. And then he talks a little bit about invasions. So let's look at the checks and balances for June 27th.
After all our doubts, our suspicions, and speculations on the subject of government, we must return at last to this important truth, that when we have formed a constitution upon free principles, when we have given a proper balance to the different branches of administration, and fixed representation upon pure and equal principles, we may with safety furnish it with all the power necessary to answer, in the most ample manner, the purposes of government. The great desiderata are free representation and mutual checks. When these are obtained, all our apprehensions of the extent of power are unjust and imaginary. What, then, is the structure of this Constitution? One branch of the legislature is to be elected by the people, by the same people who choose your state representatives. Its members are to hold their offices 2 years and then return to their constituents. Here, sir, the people govern. Here they act by their immediate representatives. You have also a Senate constituted by your state legislatures, by men in whom you place the highest confidence, and forming another representative branch. Then again, you have an executive magistrate created by a form of election which merits universal admiration. In the form of this government and in the mode of legislation, you find all the checks with the great which the greatest politicians and the best writers have ever conceived. What more can reasonable men desire? Is there any one branch in which the whole legislative and executive powers are lodged? No. The legislative authority is lodged in three distinct branches. Properly balanced, the executive divided between two branches, and the judicial is still reserved for an independent body who hold their office during good behavior. This organization is so complex, so skillfully contrived, that it is next to impossible that an impolitic or wicked measure should pass the scrutiny with success. Now, what do gentlemen mean by coming forward and declaiming against this government? Why do they say we ought to limit its power, to disable it, and to destroy its capacity of blessing the people? Has philosophy suggested, has experience taught, that such a government ought not to be trusted with everything necessary for the good of society? Sir, when you have divided and nicely balanced the departments of government, when you have strongly connected the virtue of your rulers with their interests, when, in short, you have rendered your system as perfect as human forms can be, you must place confidence. You must give power.
Is this not a general defense?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not, you know, identifying anything specific. This is borderline milquetoast. It's bland. It's, you know, I mean, I would have thought that a novice Federalist, a person that, you know, they're new, they've, you know, they don't understand the Constitution any great deal, but they could stand up and make that type of oration. I think anybody could make that kind of oration if they had a general understanding of the Constitution. And somebody that was there and was, you know, in the Constitutional Convention, could have easily dove into specific methodologies and so forth, and basically, you know, how these checks and balances would serve specifically. He didn't do that. Okay. So now he talks about, in the same day, same oration, an invasion. So let's look at that. Go ahead.
Let anyone compare the expense of supporting the civil list in a state with the expense of providing for the defense of the Union. The difference is almost beyond calculation. The experience of Great Britain will throw some light on this subject. In that kingdom, the ordinary expenses of peace to those of war are as 1 to 14. But there they have a monarch, with his splendid court and an enormous civil establishment, with which we have nothing in this country to compare. If, in Great Britain, the expenses of war and peace are so disproportioned, how wide will be their disparity in the United States? How infinitely wider between the general government and each individual state? Now, sir, where ought the great resources to be lodged? Every rational man will give an immediate answer. To what extent shall these resources be possessed? Reason says, as far as possible exigencies can require, that is, without limitation. A constitution cannot set bounds to a nation's wants. It ought not, therefore, to set bounds to its resources. Unexpected invasions, long and ruinous wars, may demand all the possible abilities of the country. Shall not your government have power to call these abilities into action? The contingencies of society are not reducible to calculations. They cannot be fixed or bounded, even in imagination. Will you limit the means of your defense when you cannot ascertain the force or extent of the evasion? Even in ordinary wars, a government is frequently obliged to call for supplies to the temporary oppression of the people.
Okay, this is interesting, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
This right here reeks of conflict with what has been said in some of the other debates, and when we get into them. There's a reason why there's that red and yellow highlight in the center. A constitution cannot set bounds to a nation's wants. It not ought, therefore, to set bounds to its resources. Now, that's interesting, because when you start looking at how that can be applied to its resources, shoot, almost anything and everything within the nation is a resource. Whether it be the land, whether it be the salt mined out of that land, or the ore. In other words, he's basically painting this picture of a very and almighty powerful general government that possesses power it shouldn't, that possesses power that has been basically asserted by other framers in the other ratification debates to say otherwise. That no, they're limited and defined. If it's not enumerated, they can't mess with it. Right here, he's basically painting a picture of general powers.
Yeah, I think he's layering it under the invasion scenario because, I mean, I can understand if the country was under threat of invasion from some dangerous destructive force that, yeah, you would want the government to be able to marshal things in a way that protects the nation.
Yeah, so I understand that. He's using,
kind of like in World War II with rationing and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I understand what you're saying in support of the warfare effort, but the line itself doesn't qualify.
No, invasion, not warfare.
You're correcting me from what I'm saying, what?
No, I'm not correcting you. I'm just saying I'm speaking of invasion, not warfare. Not where the government can say, oh, we have to go halfway around the world because it's in national interest.
Well, so
only under invasion would those powers be to marshal the resources of the country.
Yeah,
to
okay.
Country.
So invasion literally is the only warfare that the federal army would ever engage in. Based on the Constitution, that's the only warfare where we would actually be engaged with foreign invaders, foreign enemy. There's no authority in the Constitution for the government to call forth the militia and form an army to deploy that outside of the United States. The three circumstances of federalizing an army is for one, executing the laws of the Union, two, suppressing insurrections, and three, repelling invasions. So the idea of whatever warfare they can conduct, invasion is the only warfare that the federal government has been authorized to be involved in. They can't go anywhere outside the United States unless there's an amendment to the Constitution granting Congress the ability to call forth these states' militias. See, these states were not happy with the idea that, you know, they just had this direct access to their militias. They were very, as when we get into these, you're going to see how they didn't like the idea that the militia could be deployed, you know, well beyond their state, you know, to several states away, that they would be able to do this and deploy them all the way across the nation for whatever purposes out there instead of using the local resources. Back to the center, though, he's not even setting any threshold or boundaries when he says a constitution cannot set bounds to a nation's wants. It ought not, therefore, to set bounds to its resources, regardless of the purpose, whether it be for trade, because trade's one of those things that is within their powers. My point is that because he didn't qualify that line, end of sentence, boom, period. And then he uses this as an example of this warfare. But he could easily, because he's that kind of sharp lawyer, could say, well, I may not have listed using, you know, the control over our resources for trade purposes, but that's clearly within our realm and reach. I would not put anything past this man. And that's my only point. The fact that how we got Hamilton had nothing to do with the expanding of the U.S. military into doing anything and everything under the sun and being able to expand it into, you know, how many branches do we have now? Four or five? I think the Department of Transportation kind of has the Coast Guard. But we have the Space Force, the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force. And so, and that I just include the Marine Corps as a part of the Navy. And I know that's sacrilege for a Marine to say that, but, you know, it is what it is. With looking at how the government made warfare a function of business, because that function of business in controlling regimes and manipulating, you know, I'll say geopolitical conditions throughout the world was never envisioned for the United States. Never. Not at all. The idea was really to propagate liberty and peace by becoming states in the Union, because there's not, other than the Civil War over the abolition movement, and then from that we never really looked back. We've never really had true contention between states anymore. That, you know, I would think that as states would come into the Union, they would be properly prepared and so forth, regardless if they're in Europe, Asia, South America, what have you, that they would become and they would thrive as a member of the Union. But anyway, again, this is June 27th, and we're looking towards let me see here. When did this all end? I want to say it kind of ended by the end of, July 2nd is when this ended. And I'm saying July, I mean June. I keep on saying July, forgive me. This is all happening at the end of June, if I said July for June 23rd. So at this point in time, again, July 2nd being the end of the Federalist Papers, and remember, I think the last of the Federalist Papers are for the end of the debates. The last of the Federalist Papers go into August. August! To me, I think it's clear. Is Sean, you got anything else you want to add or any go-backs?
See you next time.
All right, great. Thank you so much. And so, folks, when we come back, what we're going to do is we're going to dive into the next state. And what we'll do is we'll dive into Pennsylvania because we want to go through them chronologically. But at this point, what we'll probably do is we'll just do a wrap-up in the next one of how we can do this overview now that we've read the Hamilton's positions in the Federalist Papers as well as the ratification papers. Now you can show me where Hamilton has had the same strength in his assertions. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.